Voice of Barbados, 92.9 FM, and it's Sunday evening, at around this time every Sunday evening, we bring to you the program, the Better Health Radio Show. And this evening, we have on deck Dr. Kia Lewis, and she has her guests waiting to engage her and you, the public, on this edition of the Better Health Radio Show. So let's say a special evening to Dr. Lewis and her guests. Good evening.
Hi, good evening, Gregson. How are you?
Yes, I'm happy today. I'm very good. Thank you.
Glad to hear that. I hope you had a wonderful week. It sounds so.
Yeah.
And you're happy to start of a new week.
Yeah, it was a busy week. So, yeah, it was a busy week.
Good, good. Glad to hear that. And I want to say a warm welcome, as always, to our listeners here on the Better Health Radio Show, a show which is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. It's always my pleasure to be here and to host you this evening. And we're always looking forward to an engaging and interactive session. We like to keep the topics, we like to deal with things that are topical, things that are happening now, so that we can keep you informed. But you are a big part of the show, so we want to encourage you to call in today. We want to take this opportunity to remind you, you can contact us with your questions or your comments. You can call us at 434-1790. That's 434-1790. And like I always like to say, if you're a little radio shy and you want to WhatsApp those messages, please feel free to send them to 266-4862. That's 266-4862. I want to start the program this evening, and I think you will understand why when I get into it. But I first want to offer congratulations to the government of Barbados. We know that we had the launching of the National School Nutrition Policy just this week, and we're really looking forward to seeing the outcomes of this. We want to see our children be healthier. We want to see them eat better. We want to see them move more. And in line with that, we know that this is a sports term, so there's no better time to launch it. And lots of children are engaged in knapsack and all the other meets. So today we are going to be talking about sports injuries. We're going to be talking about how to keep your children in good physical health, especially during this sports season. And with us this evening, I am very happy to welcome our highly qualified and informed guest, Miss Marita Marshall, and I'm going to introduce her to you. Miss Marshall is the owner and lead physiotherapist of POPS, that stands for Physiotherapy and Optimal Performance Services, and she is a qualified sports physiotherapist with over 10 years experience in the physiotherapy field. She holds a Bachelor of Science in Physical Therapy from UE Mona, and a master's in sports and biomechanical medicine from Dundee, UK. Not only does she operate her own private practice, but she's also the co-founder of the wellness company, the Health and Wellness Physios, Inc. Her specialty is sports rehabilitation, and she has a keen interest in public health, as well as women's sports. Men, we're not leaving you out, don't worry, she covers both. Marita has traveled and worked with a number of local and international sporting teams, including the West Indies women's cricket team. So I want you to help me warmly welcome Miss Marita Marshall to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Lewis. It's a pleasure to be here this evening.
Yes, thanks so much for making the time to be with us, because you sound like a very busy lady.
So I can be.
Yes. Like we said, we have NAPSAT, we have VSAT, we all get excited. I went to my son's sports day and I behaved like a parent in my blue shirt. Yeah, but we want to keep them safe. And so my first question is, you know, we hear about people, when we talk about physiotherapy, a lot of people might not understand. So we often hear about people who have been injured, they've been involved in an accident, and they say they're going to therapy or physiotherapy. But most people don't understand what that really is. So can you give us a little background? What are we talking about when we say physiotherapy?
So physical therapy or physiotherapy and physiotherapists work with persons from newborns throughout the entire lifespan, right up. And we basically help to reduce and manage pain. We also help persons improve their balance and mobility and manage different diseases that they might have. So as you just said, persons are most familiar with physical therapy when it comes to sports and rehabilitation from injuries or sports injuries, as well as maybe accidents and rehab that comes along with that. But physiotherapists really work with a number, a wide variety of persons. And our main aim is to really allow you to regain that function that you would have lost, help you manage your pain first and foremost, and to empower and teach you methods to manage your condition or whatever problem it is that you might have, and allow you to resume your pre-injury state or get back to as much function as you could. And there are actually a number of specialty areas within physical therapy, and I think the most popular area that most people will know about is the orthopedic area, and that refers to, you know, if you have a broken bone or a muscle strain or ankle sprain, anything like that. That's that. Those are the areas that persons are most familiar with. But we also work in neural rehabilitation, so persons who might have had a stroke or might have had some kind of brain injury, then we assist them in you know, learning to walk again, regaining their function, balance, all of these different areas. And then there's also pelvic health, women's health, there's pediatrics, there's cardiovascular, so persons who might have had some kind of heart condition, you know. So really and truthfully, we cover many, many areas, and sports rehabilitation or sports physical therapy is a very small area when it comes to physical therapy.
Excellent. So we have a great foundation to work with this evening. You guys are a very important part of the medical team. So, you know, I could ask, is it important for children and adolescents to be involved in sporting activities? But I think we all know the answer to that is yes. So what I will ask is, why do you think it's important?
Why for children? I think about getting people more active, right? And in this day and age, you know, lots of children are tuned into just playing video games or, you know, watching TV. They're just in that digital age where they're not as active as they used to be. So it's really about improving their physical activity levels and exercise, but it's also good for multi-development, for learning. Sport is a really good tool in terms of learning life skills, discipline, learning to deal with adversity, learning how to win, lose gracefully, learning how to work on a team. So, I mean, being involved in sports has many, many benefits that, you know, you can only really experience once you take part in sport. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the points that you made, apart from the physical benefits, because I want to go into those just a little bit more in terms of the health benefits of sports and just physical activity overall, but the social benefits are so important. And you alluded to that, you know, learning to be a part of a team. Think about things like pain prevention, you know, how many persons need to be actively engaged in activities and feel that feeling of significance that comes from being a part of a team, the feeling of community. So sports is a lot bigger than, you know, just physical activity that helps you to maintain good health, but it really does help with mental health, and it is beneficial for our society to have good sporting programs. With that said, though, what are some of the specific physical benefits to children? I know you talked about helping children to, you know, maintain their balance and different things, but what are some of the more specific physical benefits for children being involved in sports?
I mean, maintaining their weight is a good method of cardiovascular endurance. Learning different skills is that's a whole thing, because, you know, different sports, you have to learn different strokes, different techniques. It's all part of their development and learning from that aspect.
Yeah, I also think it's a really good foundation for health, because most people that are involved in sports, and we're going to talk about that nutrition aspect of it. You know, there's an awareness that you have to eat well, and they tend to carry on with a certain active lifestyle into adulthood. So yeah,
That's very true. I think people that are involved in sports, just like you said, you know, it's something that they are passionate about, something that they enjoy. So it's easier for them to participate in that particular activity versus trying to get up and perhaps go to the gym or to do something different. So they're able to, you know, if they were playing football as a youngster, you know, as they grow through their ages, and maybe they might not be playing competitively anymore, but then they can still run around and go for a scrimmage, and that still serves them well in terms of maintaining their levels of physical activity.
All right, so we have our first caller for the evening. Caller, welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Yes, thank you very much. Good evening. How are you, Dr. Lewis?
I am well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, I am as always well with you, and I'm happy that you're able to put us in a perspective of this very important topic. It's critical and crucial for not only the lesson of mental health, but the aspect of the way the day it interlinks with a lot of different things that are happening today based on the pandemic that we just came out of. And I have two questions. Thank you. Yes, I have two questions. The first question is, in relation to children, what would Miss Marshall, is Miss Marshall or Mrs. Marshall? Mrs. Marshall?
Miss.
So sorry, thank you. Right, Mrs. Marshall, that she would think about in terms of the hand-eye coordination or the use of the left hand or the right hand. If you're born left-handed and you have to, and especially like for a child like me, I remember I had to use my left hand at the beginning, but now I've learned to write with my right hand, and thereby then play cricket to offer shots. I bat right-handed. So you learn many different things with the left and the right hand, but what would she say would be the best for a girl or a boy? A boy right hand and a girl left hand, based on the different aspects of the game of the sport that they're learning to play at this time?
Let me see how best I can answer this question. I think some people might, you know, be right-handed in that they write with their right hand or they write with their left hand, and that's just how they are. And then surprisingly, sometimes they might switch for a particular sport. So I know say maybe in football, some people might be right-handed, but then maybe their dominant leg might be their left leg. There's no real way to classify it to male or female, left versus right. I think it's just when the person starts to play their sport, they kind of gravitate to using one side more than the other, and then they classify that as their stronger side or their dominant side. And in most cases, it's usually the same side as their writing hand, but in some cases, it could be opposite. So there isn't anything really to say girls use left hand more, boys use right hand more, or in a particular sport they're going to be more this way or that way. I think it kind of just happens organically, and it's based on the person's comfort and what they feel comfortable doing within that sport.
So there's no advantage in using the right hand and the left foot, because you know one side is closest to the heart, and you know your march left, right, left. You know, you know you would hear the person say left, 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 right, left. So I was just wondering.
No, I don't think so.
Very well, thank you very much. And the second final question, in terms of a child, whether it be a boy or a girl, a preteen, an adolescent, one that is right on the aspect or benefit of the age of 18, we grow past that, but I'm wondering about height management and what can you do to help resolve this, this challenge in terms of growing too fast. I myself have osteoarthritis disease, where I would have grown in spurts and then got this thing on my knee where, you know, I have a protrusion because of the fact that I would have grown that fast. So I'm wondering about height management and what can you do? What is most significant in terms of children who are dwarf or children who are too tall?
So in terms of height management, truthfully, I don't think there's any special way to control how fast a child is going to grow. And like you said, Asperger's is something that children may develop from time to time, which is more commonly known as growing pains.
Correct. So
when it, and if it does come up, then it's usually for a period of time. It's not going to be forever. Mm. And you really just have to manage their symptoms at that point in time and to get them through that process. So there isn't anything to really control how fast that process or how slowly that process goes. It varies from child to child, person to person.
Yes. Sorry. Yes, thank you. And what would you think would be, diet would not play any particular role? More calcium for the bones, because you know the bones are made of calcium. And wouldn't things like exercise, the same exercise, play a crucial part of the growing process, and how rapid it is, or how slow it is, or if in terms of the aspect of like I had, whenever I used to exercise, I had knee guards to help me so that when my knees would hurt and I would run, they wouldn't hurt as much, but I would still grow very tall.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to step in here a little bit. So yes, in terms of nutrition, like Ms. Marshall would have correctly said, unless there's something pathological, a disease process, like a child who is stunted, or a child who has a growth hormone imbalance that's growing extremely quickly, and that's something that's medically managed, of course, then the role of nutrition is to support the child's overall health, and it's to support their musculoskeletal system. So when you look at the bones, you look at their bone density, you look at the appropriate growth, all of that is related, of course, to their diet, so what they're eating. Yes, calcium levels, you're correct about that. But it's also related to the level of physical activity, because the more physically active you are with certain types of exercise, the more that helps to develop the bones, the ligaments, the muscles, those types of things. So when you talk about the knee pads and those kind of things, you're looking at specific injuries that a person might be prone to because of a condition they may have. And of course, a physiotherapist would work with persons individually to address those issues. But overall, when it relates to growth, the major things for children is going to be what they're eating, and it's going to be their level of physical activity. And of course, huge thing would be their genetics, right? So if you have tall family or a short family, you know, you're likely to follow the pattern of what your family does. So that's really what you're looking at there. I hope that helps.
I know that you mentioned family. These generational diseases have been less and less the further back you go past World War II, where, you know, there were certain, they were fed less, so they would get less calcium and the rations would be less, so therefore they wouldn't grow as fast. And then at the same time, they didn't have a lot of these new, these diseases that are plaguing people, that have plagued people like me, which is my testimony, and my family going back. So it is very good. Thanks very much for asking the questions. And it is very good that how in the past it was a lot more normal due to the better dietary effects in terms of a better diet, more nutrients in the food and so on, and how the atmosphere around them, there was less. More things to do. Sorry for that. More things to do. Thereby, the activity level was increased. Thereby, the height and so on would have been a lot better. So, thanks very much. Have a nice evening. All best. Bye bye. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Thanks so much for calling. All right. So, we had a lot of information there regarding to some things that we're probably going to talk a little bit more about later. But we really thank the caller for his contribution. So, I want to find out from you, though, Ms. Marshall. We talk about physiotherapy, we always think about injuries, but is there a role for the physiotherapist for young athletes outside of injuries?
Yes, most definitely. I think the role of the physiotherapist is going to be in injury prevention. It's also going to be in helping to monitor and manage their loads in terms of how much they're doing. And this would be going into, you know, persons who are starting to play certain sports from a young age. And then also managing any injuries that might come up. So in terms of injury prevention, we really try to introduce good practices from a young age, because, you know, the younger that they start doing, you know, knowing what to eat before training, what to eat after, how to stretch properly, understanding their muscle groups and simple things like that, then it kind of stays with them. And as they transition into possibly being more competitive or into even professional athletes, then it makes, you know, they already have that good foundation that they can continue to build on. So definitely there's a role there for the physiotherapist in especially managing their loads and monitoring how much they're doing, and then helping to teach and teach them good practices to prevent injuries from occurring.
All right. And I imagine there would be some general advice. However, the advice given might vary based on the type of sport that the person is involved in. So my question then would be, are there any particular sports, and I figure this is true, that have a higher risk of injury? And if so, which ones?
Which sports have a higher risk of injury? I mean, generally contact sports are going to have a greater risk of injury, just because, you know, there's contact happening and those injuries can happen at any point in time. Apart from that, we really try to teach, as I said just now, you know, knowing and understanding how to warm up properly, how to cool down properly, how to do what kind of stretching needs to be done before exercise, what kind of stretching needs to be done after. So before, you want to do more dynamic stretching, and that just helps to warm up the tissues, get the body ready for exercise. And after, then when you actually sit and do static stretches where you actually hold your stretches for maybe between 15 to 30 seconds, and then making them aware of good recovery techniques to use, after teaching them about the importance of hydration, those kind of things.
Okay. And what are some of the more common injuries that we see among young athletes? What are some of the more common injuries that you have to deal with?
So the most common things would be muscle strains, sprains, ligament sprains, and then possibly contact, like contusions, ankle sprains are quite common. Knee pain is generally common as well. Back pain from time to time, depending on the sport. If it's a throwing sport, then you can expect shoulder injuries, rotator cuff strains. Yeah, so it really varies based on the sport.
Okay. And what is some of the more common management modalities? I know that, of course, that will vary based on the injury, but for example, for muscular sprains, among other things, what are some of the more common things that persons can do to manage these injuries?
I think most persons will be familiar with a concept called RICE, mm-hmm. which stood for rest, ice, compression, and elevation. Since then, that's been kind of updated to POLICE, which kind of stands for Protect, Optimal Load, Ice, Compression, and Elevation. So that initial rest is now replaced with protection, optimal loading, and then the rest of it remains. So the old concept was that if you had an injury, you know, typically they would say you need to rest for a week, 2 weeks, sit down at home, do nothing. But, you know, research has shown that it's better to begin loading or moving and doing rehab from a lot earlier. So the concept of protection is that, you know, you want to protect that area as much as possible. That might be in using an assistive device like crutches to offload that area that needs to be offloaded a bit. And then once it's okay, then you begin to what they call optimal load. So that's when you actually start to do maybe some range of motion exercises, gentle strengthening exercises, and then continue with the traditional icing, compression, and elevation. So I would say the main thing to remember there, to take away, because I think most people are still with the concept of resting for a long period of time. So then you would have someone that perhaps had an ankle sprain, and then they didn't really do anything with it, but they sat at home for about 2 weeks, and then they noticed that, you know, it wasn't getting better, the swelling was still there, they're still not able to walk on it properly, and then they might seek professional help. So my advice is better to get that help early on,
yeah,
so that you can get information on how to manage and at what stage to do what. Another thing that people always get confused with is when to use ice versus heat. So traditionally, you know, you have that new injury that occurs, and people then go straight into warm water, Epsom salts, or those kind of things. Yeah. So that is something that we still see, yeah, a lot of, and or running to put a heat rub, you know, in the early stage and there's swelling. So generally, if something just happens, if there's swelling, if there's tenderness and that kind of stuff, you definitely would want to more go towards the compression route and icing, just to help manage that swelling that's occurring. So heat and that hot water, those hot water soaks actually could increase swelling, right? And then people would come and say, well, you know, and it's more swollen, or this thing isn't getting any better. And then you ask them what they were doing, and then they say, yeah, I've been putting it in Epsom salt and some hot water every day from the time it happened. And so I think for sure, two concepts to be mindful of are no longer taking that rest, that absolute period of a full week to 2 weeks of absolute rest. And then being mindful that, you know, if something just happened and there's swelling, there's tenderness, you more want to work on compression, elevation, icing. And then after you pass that, what we would call acute stage, which is generally between 2 days to 5 days, or sometimes it could be just over that, maybe a full week, 7 days. Once you pass that stage, then, you know, that's when you could begin to think about using heat and doing those soaks.
Yeah, I think that information is so rich, because you answered two questions that I was going to ask, and one of the main ones, of course, was about whether you should seek medical attention, how soon you should seek that attention, and then the second one, this confusion. So often in the office, people with injuries present and say they use warm water and Epsom salts, because, you know, Epsom salts cures everything naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But, we do get that a lot, and people don't often recognize that ice is the first thing, something cold is the first thing to use. So thank you so much for you know, putting that out there. What I do want you to do is to expand a little bit for us on the compression and elevation, adding that, because that may be obvious to us as health professionals, but some people might not understand those terms and practically what that looks like.
Okay, so for the compression, you really want to get an elastic bandage and wrap that area, that swollen area. No, I will try not to be too you know, specific, but we would generally try to do a figure of eight as opposed to a circular bandage wrap. But I mean, obviously, if you're doing it on your own at home, you know, any kind of compression, once it isn't restricting your blood flow, then that's better than no compression at all, right? So an elastic bandage is what you would want to use, or there's compression sleeves that you can just pull on. There's some that you can get from any pharmacy that just pull onto the ankle or just pull on to the knee. So any compression that's in an elastic bandage is what you would be looking for. And then in terms of elevation, you want to elevate that limb or body part above the level of the heart. So if you're laying down, you're able to put your foot up on a couple cushions, then that will naturally bring that leg above the level of the heart, and the same thing for an arm.
Okay. And you mentioned just now about compression. You said you want to compress, but you don't want it to be too tight. And I agree with that, because you can make an injury much worse. You can have compression injuries on top of the existing injury, and those can be limb-threatening. So what are some signs that you would look for that your compression bandage is a little bit too tight?
So, I mean, for those that might be medically inclined, I know about capillary refill. But otherwise, you can check, like, if it's your foot, you can look at the toes. Mm-hmm. And if it looks, you know, like it's swollen or it looks like it's a bit red or, you know, if you put something on too tight, you can kind of tell that the skin and tissue is kind of, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but like, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, plumping up. But those are kind of things you would want to check to make sure, you know, that it's not too tight. Yeah. Yeah. Or that, you know, it doesn't feel like it's throbbing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You want to make sure too that it's not getting at the those toes or those fingers or whatever, they're not getting cold or numb.
Yes.
Those are also signs that the bandage may be too tight and you need to release the bandage.
Take it off. Yeah.
Good information. So we're talking about sports injuries. I want to remind our listeners, you have the opportunity to interact with Ms. Marshall, who is a sports physiotherapist. You can call us at 434-1790. That's 434-1790 with your questions or comments. And of course, you can send your WhatsApp messages to 266-4862. That's 266-4862. We talked quite a bit now about how the general principles of managing an injury. We said that we don't necessarily want to rest for too long. We want to protect the injury and then get back to movement in a safe way as soon as possible. But we know that prevention is always the best medicine, right? So give us some tips for parents whose children are involved, especially in track and field or other events, in terms of how they can go about preparing their children for these events to prevent injuries.
Yeah, so I mean, in some cases, you know, injuries will happen and you just have to deal with it. But like you said, we always want to do as much as we can to prevent injuries from occurring if possible. So that warm up that you do before activity is so important. Also making sure that the children have a chance to train and get some practice for whatever event or whatever activity is they're going to do. So we know it's sports term and, you know, people are always looking for kids to jump in on events and stuff, but you want to make sure that in the lead up to the big sports day that they have a chance to practice and to get accustomed to whatever race, if it's a track event or whatever skill it is that they need to be able to perform. So for warming up, I think warming up and cooling down, generally athletes might not want to pay too much attention to that because they just want to jump straight into the activity itself or they just want to go and run their race. But having a good warm-up helps to prepare the body, the heart, the muscles, the tissues, and everything for that activity. So placing emphasis on that is very important. And I think that's something that the parents could also reinforce for their children. Make sure that you warm up before you actually go run or you warm up before you go play football or whatever activity is that they're going to be doing and help them to understand why that's important, you know, in making sure that their body, mind, and everything is ready for that activity and also to prevent any injuries, any muscle strains from occurring.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also think even like the night before the days leading up, making sure that children are getting adequate amounts of rest is so important.
Yes.
Sometimes athletes are pushed to the hilt. Sometimes they're very eager and up to the day before they're really pushing themselves when they should be resting, especially the nighttime. So making sure that as a parent, you know, they're not being pushed too hard, they're getting adequate amounts of rest and hydration.
Yes, I was just
start on the day, it starts leading up all the way up, you know, that those muscles and the heart, the circulatory system, everything is prepared to go, you know, on that day. So I think I agree with you, the stretches, the warm-ups, the mindset, Marita.
Yes, Yes, very important as well. You know, thinking through doing that visualization. And like you said, hydration is very, very important. And most people, like you said, you know, will only think about it after the particular event is done. But you need to start hydrating days before that activity. And if you're training, even before, after training, it's an ongoing process, you know?
Yeah, so very, very good points there. Now, I know that there are some star athletes out there, and we are often very proud of them as parents. And schools tend to want to include them in every event. They're doing lots and lots of events in a day. So I guess my question, because this isn't my area, how many events is it really safe to be a part of? How much is too much? You might not be able to give a particular number, but there might be a way that we can quantify how much is too much for the average child to be involved in. Does that vary based on their age or the activity?
That is a really good question, and I'm trying to think of the best way to answer you. It's tricky. It's hard to say exactly a number. Like you said, it's really hard to say a particular number. I think the best way to look at it is the individual. You have to look at the child that you're dealing with. You have to look at perhaps the how close together those events are, or is it going to be a lot of events are going to be back to back to back? You know, is it going to be spread out? Is the competition going to be spread out on a whole day? Or, you know, there's so many different factors to consider. Some athletes are stronger than others. So, you know, that person might be able to do a little bit more. And then, like, kind of like what you said earlier, you have to be in tune with that child or that athlete, get feedback from them. How are they feeling? Is it that they're feeling tired? Do they feel overworked? Because they can give you very, you know, informative feedback on how they actually feel. So I think it's a number of factors to consider. And then you also monitor as a parent, you would be able to see, you know, well, you know, when they, on this particular evening, they're really exhausted and they can't do much the following day, or, you know, this particular event or activity, I find they're not able to recover as quickly, or they don't perform as well. So then you kind of use all of those guidelines to help determine, well, you know, cut down what they should do and what they shouldn't do, or how much they should do. Look at maybe what they're better at, and maybe focus on those. So yeah, I would say it's really looking at everything overall to determine how much to do and which events maybe should be taken out or reduced.
Yeah, again, very good points, because, you know, we say listen to our bodies, but we also have to listen to our children. Yes, the same way you listen to your body, mm-hmm. you have to listen to your children when they're saying, you know, it's a bit too much, or something is hurting, or, you know, you really do. This is not for parents, but of course it will go for coaches and teachers, because we recognize that all teachers aren't professional coaches. They may be organizing who's going to run what, but they might not be trained specially in that area. So listening to what the athletes are saying is extremely important. So we have a caller this evening. Caller, we want to welcome you specially to the Better Health Program.
Thank you so much. This is Anthony Hope calling. I almost forgot that I used to be involved in exercise programs. But what I wanted to ask the therapist is, in terms of, we're always hearing about athletes and being focused, mentally focused. But quite a few years ago, or more than a few years ago, I used to use a out-of-the-class exercise program to get the students to stay focused in terms of response within classroom, of answering questions, of doing things as per skill, as recommended and all that. I was wondering how much could... Is it Mrs. Marshall? Give some views on how you can use exercise to get students to stay mentally focused on projects and objects, and in terms of setting goals, being successful.
Yeah, well, I think exercise generally helps to boost your stimulation and mood and focus. It helps to improve focus. So just being involved in activities can definitely help. And I'm sure that even for yourself, you might have come up with certain activities within the classroom, like maybe standing and doing some squats, or standing and raising their hands up and down, or a couple jumping jacks, you know, stand from the desk and do some jumping jacks, and then get back to whatever task that they need to do in terms of in the classroom itself. So using exercise or different parts of physical activity or methods like that can definitely help to improve children's focus and it keeps them entertained and excited, I guess, because they like these kind of activities. So it's a good method to use to try.
And one more thing, the level of expectations for people who are involved with students. Now, I used to do a program for a student who had sloppy behavior. Could you explain what is sloppy behavior for the others, the other listeners?
Sloppy behavior?
Yes, please.
Why don't you help us, Mr. Hope?
I think we might need a little assistance there. Maybe there's another term that we don't have.
I prefer to give the professionals the chance to explain what is sloppy behavior.
Yeah, but they might have a different name for what you might eventually explain to us. So let's see where you're going with this sloppy behavior, and let's see what they'll come up with after that. Because I'm thinking about it, too, and I'm thinking sloppy behavior is slack behavior. But anyhow, let me hear what you have to say.
Sorry, sloppy behavior.
Floppy with an F or... say it again?
Yeah, in other words, the person may not be able to stand up on his or her own situations. The person may not be able to move their eyelids or eyebrows from one end to the other. They may not be able to raise a hand. They may not be able to stand erect, and you may have to give them support all the way to get them to stay up, to even move their eyebrows, to even speak.
Right, so you're talking about some type of musculoskeletal disorder, that can happen with a... So sloppy behavior is a term I've never heard, to be honest with you, but the symptoms could refer to a number of musculoskeletal disorders that you can have. And that's really something that needs to be medically managed. Physiotherapists, of course, would have a role in the medical management of that condition. But it will be, the management is going to vary based on the condition of what is causing it.
Well, I don't want to say what caused that particular one, but I'm saying that you would be able to help ease the discomfort that lots of parents have who born children that develop that sloppy behavior. So I thought you would have been a better person, far better than I am, to explain to the public, because people, families go through a lot of stress and anxiety, even to the stage of getting a divorce, having to deal with
that,
have sloppy behavior.
If you have a condition that is that severe, it would be, most parents would seek medical attention. Ms. Marshall, you were saying something.
No, I was saying it was sounding as though it's a child with maybe a developmental delay or some kind of developmental issue. So that's a little bit different. You know, they would have to get specialized treatment for that. So, yes, that's managing a child like that would be a little bit different. The approach would have to be different.
Okay, Mr. Hope.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you kindly, sir. And you have a wonderful evening. No?
All right. Okay. So we talked about preparation for the meet. We talked about treating sports injuries, all of those things. But after the big meet and the chair has either won a medal or they've got their participation points and we're now heading home, how can parents help the child to recover? So we know we talked about warming down and all of that, but what are some more recovery tips when you're at home for children after a big meet?
So that's where nutrition comes in, and the cool down doesn't always happen right after the race or event. Sometimes they can go home after and maybe do some stretches. You also want to begin that rehydration process. So having that water, if it has been a long hot day, they should really have been hydrating also with electrolytes to replace what is lost in their sweat. And then having a meal. So, you know, you need to have a meal or a sandwich of some sort to help to rebuild your carbohydrate energy stores and to help rebuild those muscles that would have been working so hard throughout that activity. So hydration, having a meal, and doing some stretching afterwards for sure.
Right. And I'm so glad you brought up the whole thing about having a meal, because for a lot of people, celebration involves having a meal, but a very unhealthy meal, which means spinning through, either the drive-through or, you know, going somewhere and just picking out on the whatever that person wants, whatever tastes good. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what the diet for an athlete, and really this should go for all children, a healthy, balanced diet, but specifically for athletes. There's this misconception that because the child is very active and they might look slim and toned and trim, that that child can eat whatever they want. In fact, when we talked about the National School Nutrition Policy, we got a lot of pushback. The children just need to rumble more. If they rumble more, we don't have to worry about what they have to eat, right? But we know that this is a serious misconception. So I want you to tell us a little bit about diets among athletes. What are your takes on... I know you're not a nutritionist, but how should athletes eat in preparation for a meet? How should they eat after the meet? And then just in preparation for a healthy lifestyle overall.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, nutrition and good nutrition habits, we would like to get enforced from a young age. But as you grow and as you get more serious as an athlete and become more professional, then you know, it can become very specific. So generally, you're going to need to be able to fuel your body to meet the demands of what you're doing, right? So that basically just means, you know, if you're running around all day, have 5 races for the day, obviously you can't eat the same way as if you weren't doing anything at all, right? So if you're doing events, then you might need to take along a few extra snacks. And those snacks could be, you know, maybe raisins, some nuts, some dry fruit, some fresh fruit.
You mean not corn kernels?
No, not corn kernels.
And not gummy bears and chocolate. No. So the sugar could get enough sugar?
No. I'm not talking about that stuff. We're not talking about that stuff at all. And I mean, if you want to go the route of chocolate milk after playing sports or after lots of activity is actually beneficial. So if you want something sweet, then we can have some chocolate milk. That's good. That helps to rebuild protein, carbohydrates, rebuild those muscles that would have started to break down in that activity, that hard, strenuous activity. So we can have some chocolate milk, you know. We really don't want to go too heavy on all these sugars, which we know is in all these sweet drinks. To most person's surprise, in the juices as well, those are full of sugar. But we want to focus on having water. We want to also rehydrate with electrolytes, like I said. So that is your Powerade, your Gatorade, and even in those cases, sometimes, you know, we might have to dilute those because those can be sweet as well. And there's also Pedialyte, which is also a less sugary option to have those electrolytes. And then anything from dried fruit, fresh fruit, plantain chips are good. Those ones are easily accessible. Nuts, raisins, that kind of stuff. And then afterwards, we want to have perhaps Hamachi sandwich is really easy to make, and that's something that can be packed and prepared from beforehand so that you don't actually have to drive through the fat drive-through to get any what did the kids like, the kids' meals or the chicken breast sandwiches and the unhealthy stuff. You know what we mean,
right?
So there's methods: peanut butter and jam sandwiches, a nice turkey ham sandwich. There's so many options out there that are quick and easy, much healthier alternatives and healthier options that will allow you to replenish, rebuild, and prepare for that next bolt of competition or training or whatever it is you need to do. And I always like to tell athletes, you are what you eat. So, you know, if you're eating junk, then your body doesn't really process that. It's not doing anything for you.
Right.
So, you know, your muscles are not gonna be able to rebuild. Your energy stores are gonna be empty and depleted because you haven't put anything back in there to help rebuild it. So that's really important, and I think parents really, really, really need to emphasize that and help push their children in that kind of direction, because like I said, everything that we start to do from a young age, you know, it just makes it a lot easier when they're already used to drinking water. They're not going to be craving any sweet drinks. When they're used to having fruit and healthy snacks in between, they're not going to be craving any corn curls, you know. So building these good practices from a young age is very important. And then the children, as they, you know, get older and grow away from their parents, there is no need to try to change or break those bad habits. It's already part of them, and they you know, they're used to it. So
yeah, and they can pass it on to their children as well.
Definitely.
I really love the point that you made about, didn't put it in this way, but empty calories. Sometimes we focus so much on getting in energy, but we're not looking at the nutrient content. And if you have somebody who is very active, they need nutrients, especially growing children. They need to be eating nutrient-dense foods. So yes, they can fill up at the fast food restaurants. Yes, they can use all these sweet drinks and different things, but it's not adding any benefit to the body. The most it's doing is giving them a little energy boost, making them feel good, but it's not going to optimize their performance. And that's what we're looking to do. If you are serious about your children performing well in sports, performing well in life, just being healthy, you know, avoiding, there are athletes that have diabetes and high blood pressure. There are athletes that end up with amputations and heart attacks like everybody else. Because if you're active, but the diet isn't right, you are going to have those problems. The heart, you know, the different vessels in the body, the brain, you're going to have issues. So this is a very good opportunity to remind parents that your children, whether they're into sports or not, need to have nutrient dense foods. They absolutely need it as a foundation. We find among children there are a lot of nutrient deficiencies. So the children are eating more than ever, but they have less nutrients in the diet than ever before. So we want to remind parents, you need nutrient dense foods, those fruits, those vegetables. We have another caller on the line. Caller, welcome to the Better Health Radio program.
Thank you very much indeed. Great night. Just very quickly, because I know the program is going to close right now, and I think it was a very, very explicit and sweet one. So mentioning about the sweet, now there was a video that I had watched before based on the fat of milk and carrot, and how the vitamin A in the milk, the retinol and so on, when synthesized by the liver, it gets into the liver and so on, you get the vitamin A, which is obviously good for the skin and so on, the eyesight, that kind of thing. But the pro-vitamin A in a carrot, in terms of beta-carotene, when the liver assimilates it and breaks it down, it breaks down into two molecules of the same retinol. So I was wondering what would be the area of, in terms of for children, those children who are coming up and having alternative diet rather than the meat, the vegetarian, the vegan, the raw food, that kind of thing, very quickly.
Just to clarify, Just to clarify, Carly, you're speaking specifically as it relates to vitamin A or just in general?
No. What I'm referring to is stuff like, you know how when you eat a piece of chicken and you're getting the white portion, you know, they say for children that would be good for more of those athletes who are sprinting. And then you take the brown part of the chicken, it's better for those who are running longer distances, the 800, the 1500, the 5000, and so on. So I was just wondering, in terms of for zoning, keying in and zoning, zooming in on that aspect, the mentioning the carrot example before with the milk, as well as this chicken, is it good that we could have healthy alternative diets, especially in the light of the school nutrition policy that was just passed for our children? Thank you.
Yeah, so okay. Ms. Marshall, would you like me to... Okay, all right, got to go ahead for her. So a couple of things. I'm not a nutritionist, so in terms of the specifics, like whether the white meat, I will always tell you when I do not know specifically, right? So in terms of the white meat and the brown meat, I understand where that is coming from, because different muscle, there are different types of muscle in different parts of the chicken or whatever, different parts of the meat. So those some types would be higher in myoglobin, and you know, in terms of how that relates to nutrition, I'm not 100% sure. That said, you did mention something I want to pick up on that's very important. We talked about alternative diets like vegan diets, vegetarian diets, and I want to pick up on that simply because, of course, we would recommend a balanced diet for children because you want to have the nutrients. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to vegan diets, one of the dangers of a vegan diet is things like B12 deficiency.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can, in the attempt to, you know, to restrict certain things from strong restrictions from the diet for children, except for like, I don't know, sugars, free sugars. In the attempt to restrict actual food groups like carbohydrates or proteins or meats or whatever, meat isn't a food group, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I do. Of course I do. No.
You can end up with certain nutrient deficiencies. So what I say to parents, even though the vegan lifestyle might be your lifestyle, we're not saying that you cannot find ways to practice it with your children, but you really should be guided by a nutritionist or a pediatrician that specializes in that area, because all pediatricians do not specialize in that area. All nutritionists might not be attuned to what a child might need for a vegan diet. Yeah? So I would not advise persons to try to institute a vegan or a low carb or a keto or any of those things in a child without the guidance, without either the advice, so this is what you should do, a doctor or a nutritionist saying this is what is beneficial for this child because of a particular condition, or if you are interested in it without first consulting sound advice, you can significantly hamper the development of that child. We talk about B12 deficiency, we're looking at things as serious as paralysis among children. And we talk about things like iron deficiency. Iron deficiency actually delays their ability, their cognitive ability. So you're now looking at learning, learning disabilities, etc. So that's a really important point.
A lack of energy, fatigue, chronic fatigue, as well, getting into things like how people with sickle cell need more iron as well. So with the children that would have the sickle cell, well, they will be the ones that would need the iron, and it would be advisable that the children, as you said, should go to a nutritionist and should seek out dietary help so that they can manage their, especially going into school now with this whole new world that they're going to face with this school nutrition policy. Thank you very much.
All right, sir. Thank you kindly as well. Doc, over to you as we wrap up for this evening.
Yes, sir. Absolutely wrapping up this evening. I just wanted to ask one more question. And that is, are there any, and I know that there are, but what are some of the specific physical conditions that might stop a child from being involved in sports? It's a very broad range of questions, but I'm sure that there's some that come up commonly. And how can you treat to this? So if you have a child that has a particular condition, is there any role of the physiotherapist maybe in helping that child to become more active?
Well, it depends on what the condition is. There's some that you would obviously need the advice of your doctor. So, you know, certain cardiovascular conditions, for instance, like exercise-induced asthma, that's one that can affect how much persons do, but can be managed. Obviously, contagious or any kind of infection that, you know, that is active. So I think those are some of them off the top of my head, but that is something that definitely will have to be managed with the guidance of a doctor. So first of all, making the correct diagnosis so we understand exactly what's happening with the person, and then taking that diagnosis and seeing if it's something that's treatable, if it's something that is that they have to live with for life, and how can we manage that condition, and what sport or what activity would match that condition or would not cause it to be aggravated. There's a wide variety of sports. Like I said, you know, there's a holy host of different levels of activity. So, you know, where a person might not be able to participate in football, but, you know, might be able to play another sport that doesn't require so much of them. So, yeah.
And I think the reason why we ask that question is because, for example, asthma is an excellent example. When persons say, well, my child is asthmatic, so they can't participate in athletics, and they might be really gifted, they're asthmatic, so they can't do the average thing, when we know that that's something that can be managed. So I think, along with that, the take-home point is, if you have a child concerned, you have a medical condition, let the doctor be the one to say, this child should not participate. Don't make that the call on your own, because there are perhaps things that the medical practitioner, along with the physiotherapist, can do to help that child be involved in the physical activities, and you can also read out those, like you said, that are suitable for that child. So, Ms. Marshall, we are at the end of the program. I want to say thank you so much. I'm going to give you just a couple seconds. Any take-home message that you want the people of Barbados to have before you go?
I just really want to drive home that point again about seeking professional advice early if an injury occurs. I think that's very, very important. Just getting that guidance early o'clock, knowing what to do in those early stages of an injury occurring, and getting that guidance on when to progress and when to do what is super, super important, versus trying to do it on your own and then coming back after 2 weeks when you realize it's not working, and then we kind of have to, you know, patch things up and see how best we can manage. So seeking professional help early, from a physiotherapist, from a doctor that can guide you to a physio if you need. And then that concept of absolute rest. We've really, really, really gone away from that concept now. So, you know, if an injury happens, yes, you might need some form of rest. But again, getting advice and help on how much, what's needed, how to protect the area, what needs to be done. Same point again. Everything is not to be dumped in Epsom salts and hot water right away. You know, heat is ready to be used after at least a week of an injury occurring. If there's swelling there, you do not want to be putting heat on swelling and an acute injury. And then I really just want to encourage everyone listening, and not just, you know, athletes, just this is for everyone, to try to adopt healthier eating practices, you know, healthier lifestyles in terms of being physically active, engaging in exercise. All of these things, you know, are very beneficial to, you know, managing yourself and having a good quality of life, avoiding those non-communicable diseases like diabetes and hypertension and all these things. So, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Marshall. Thanks to you, Gregson, as always. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in with us on another Better Health program. We look forward to interacting again with you next week.
All right, Doctor, thank you so kindly. Your host for this evening was Dr. Kia Lewis. And since there was so much concern regarding Miss or Mrs. Marshall, it's M-I-S-S, Miss Marika Marshall. She was our guest
this
evening. You're very welcome, ma'am. She was our guest this evening, and we want to thank her and Dr. Lewis for coming by on the Better Health Radio Show to share their expertise. Of course, my usual question, Doc, it's you next week, or is it?
I think we're going to have another doctor on next.
Another doctor. All right. So listen out. You'll find out who that is next week, but be sure to join us for another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. So, ladies, thank you kindly, and have a wonderful evening.